From the Sky News Centre at 6, the Queen has been joined by many veterans at St Paul's Cathedral for a service commemorating the end of the UK involvement in the war in Afghanistan. A flypast and parade also honoured the 453 British servicemen and women who died in the 13-year conflict. New details have emerged about how three British schoolgirls may have got into Syria. It's after videos were found on the phone of a man arrested in Turkey. Matt Steele has more.
15-year-old Shamima Begum and Amira Abbasi and Khadija Sultana, who's 16, are seen getting out of a taxi, apparently in a town near the border with Syria.
Take the Syrian passport.
That's the voice of a foreign spy who Turkish officials accuse of helping the girls. This seems to explain how they were able to cross the border. The girls are now understood to be in Raqqa with Islamic State militants.
The head of Greater Manchester Police has defended its decision not to discipline any officer over the failures to investigate grooming in Rochdale. The force is facing legal action from two victims after a damning new report. Chief Constable Sir Peter Fahey's apologised and warned the problem hasn't gone away.
Clearly there have been some serious misjudgments in this. We've done a huge amount of work to improve the way we deal with this. But I have to be honest as well, there are some of those failings in the system, some of the weaknesses in the system are still very much there, and that's what concerns me.
DJ Neil Fox has been arrested over an allegation he sexually assaulted a woman in the early 1990s. The 53-year-old, who was questioned over separate allegations by five other women last year, attended a police station to answer bail. Another military healthcare worker has been evacuated from Sierra Leone after potentially being exposed to Ebola. They aren't currently showing symptoms. That's the latest. I'm Elizabeth Williams.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. The mafia don in charge of the world's biggest criminal elite protection racket gave a speech about East-West relations this week. I'm talking about Henry Kissinger. But that's not how the BBC introduced him. So what is the organisation he controls, and what did Henry Kissinger have to say? Also, the Jewish former head of the US Army War College, Alan Sobrowski, disagrees with the Bishop of Guildford over whether the Israeli government and military may have been the terrorists behind the 9/11 attacks. We hear a recent interview with him tonight, which has been banned from British airwaves because Ofcom have banned the English language Iranian channel Press TV, who interviewed him. Also, a year after the disappearance of Malaysian Airlines flight MH370 from Kuala Lumpur to Beijing, what have or haven't we been told about what is and isn't known? Why is the Rolls-Royce and Maldives smoking guns? Why do they implicate the Western media itself in misleading the whole world over what happened? Plus, more from the band Reverend Stephen Sizer with a breakdown of the modern medieval style heresy so popular in the US, that's Christian Zionism. But I think we'll start this week with Mike Birkin from Southwest Friends of the Earth. Hi, Mike. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Hello, Tony. Good evening.
Now, we've got a bit of an ongoing situation up at Stapleton Allotments with a whole load of very highly paid lawyers and also some bailiffs and private security trying to evict a whole load of people from trees, which are standing in the way of some new, wonderful public transport system that we've been asking for decades in the city. So, anyway, what are your thoughts about the rights and wrongs of Metrobus and using this particular site as part of the Metrobus route?
It's not an issue I've been really close to, Tony, but I'm persuaded by the argument of the Metrobus opponents, who say that it's a very expensive scheme that will have very little benefit in terms of persuading people onto onto using public transport instead of using cars for their commuter journeys. They say that it will attract perhaps only a few hundred extra bus users, and some of those would be people transferring from other bus routes anyway.
So it's really a replacement for existing public transport that's already there and routes that are already being served.
In part, it will function in that way, yes, because it will give people who are coming from outside of Bristol into the city centre in the morning and out again in the evening a more attractive route, a quicker route.
And now we keep hearing that Bristol's one of the, if not the most congested city in Europe. What would Friends of the Earth like to see done, if not Metro Bus?
Well, I think what we're seeing, some of the things we're seeing happening around the city are good. I just cycled down Eastern Way this evening and I noticed as I came down on the left-hand side, it's a bit of a nightmare right now, but on the left-hand side they're building a separate, proper segregated Dutch-style cycle lane. And these are starting to appear around the city now. Still, it's only fragmentary, but we ought to have a proper comprehensive cycle lane network that takes you from one side of the city to the other, and a good web connecting all the different parts of the centre of the city, and then it becomes much more feasible for people to think about using bikes for short journeys, which most of the journeys in Bristol are.
I mean, it's amazing, isn't it? I mean, for anyone sitting in a car in the traffic right now, you see the bicycles, the cycles and motorbikes going past you. It's quite frustrating. You think to yourself, well, actually, I wouldn't mind cycling if there was a reasonably safe route that I could use. And surely that's, you know, one of the answers is we need these dedicated cycle routes for those, but that only really serves commuters who are commuting within Bristol.
Yeah, I don't know the exact statistics off the top of my head, but you know the majority of journeys will be journeys of probably around 5 miles or less, and so it could make a huge difference just transferring those journeys from off of public transport and road vehicles onto bikes.
What makes me laugh is quite a lot of these people who are in their cars then go along to the gym, don't they, and do a kind of cycle on the spot for however many hours in order to keep fit.
Yeah, it's a strange irony. I can understand why people feel nervous about cycling on the roads, and there's an issue of air quality in the city as well. I mean, maybe people feel that their health is better served by doing it in an air-conditioned gym than doing it on breathing in the roads, the fumes on the roads in Bristol.
We also have the cycling charity campaign, Sustrans, based in the city. One would have hoped that we got a little bit further with these dedicated cycle lanes.
Yeah, I think, well, Bristol actually is now one of the leading cities in the UK for introducing dedicated cycle lanes. And let me just kind of answer my own question there, that about the health benefits of cycling, it's very clear that actually that if you get regular exercise for half an hour or so every day, that then that has long-term benefits for your heart and lungs that outweigh the risk of breathing polluted air. So it's a thing to be recommended.
Have you ever seen a really good public transport scheme, like a proper tram scheme, rather than this kind of half-hearted metro bus, guided bus thing?
Oh, yeah, they have them in some other places in the UK.
Any chance of it here, though?
Well, it's... The government has blown hot and cold about providing proper tram services for UK cities for decades, and Bristol's always been a victim of that. It's kind of come and gone out of fashion and back into fashion again, and Bristol's never got its act together to get a scheme before the government at the time when it's in fashion. Hopefully with the new agenda around devolution, which looks like it's going to be something that gains extra traction, whoever wins the next general election, cities will begin more control over their transport budgets. You know, we might be in a position where Bristol can start to make its own decision about the kind of transport system it wants, rather than having to go and plead its case before Department of Transport and Treasury every time.
Okay, any real chance of this happening, though? Because we hear it, don't we? I know about you, but I've certainly getting to the point where I'm thinking, is it ever going to happen?
Well, it seems to be something that now is gathering political momentum that is going to be very difficult for any government to stop after the general election.
Okay. What about some of the bigger issues, energy issues outside the city? Latest on Hinkley Power Station, is that going to happen? And also, of course, the potential for fracking in the Mendips. Both of these have a big environmental impact too, don't they?
Yeah, so let me say something about fracking first. We have had some relatively good news just this week. In Sussex, one of the exploration companies that wanted to frack, I think, one site within and one site just outside the South Downs National Park, has withdrawn its applications. And the reason they did this is that because of public pressure, the government was forced during the passage of the infrastructure bill last month to come out and say that there would be an outright ban on fracking in national parks and areas of outstanding beauty. Now, this has implications, and clearly that the fracking companies have realised that it's going to make it difficult for them to get planning applications through in those areas. This has implications for us in the southwest. A lot of the southwest is designated area of outstanding natural beauty. Much of the Mendip area is designated area of outstanding natural beauty. So I think that has to be good news for people resisting fracking across much of Britain, although there will still be areas, of course, that are outside those protected zones.
Now, Martin, I'll bring you in to talk about this, because there's also been a big change, hasn't there, in the oil price, which has potentially made the whole idea of fracking less viable.
Well, indeed, and there are various theories about why that's happened. It's partly to do with the slowdown in the world economy. That's the most worrying thing, the demand for oil has gone down.
Don't OPEC normally just rein back supply?
Well, that's what they normally do, but the Saudis in particular have decided not to do that. And because they, it looks like they agreed it with the Americans as a means of trying to pressurise the Russians over Syria and Ukraine. But of course, it has.
Well, how does that have that effect?
Well, because the Russians are dependent to a large extent on oil exports, so the crashing of the oil price causes major problems for their economy. And of course, with the standoff over Syria and Ukraine, the Saudis are piling on the pressure. They can afford to have a low oil price for longer than anybody else. But of course, a side effect of that has been to basically undermine the fracking bubble in the United States of America rather than in Britain. And of course, the danger with that is that the fracking industry is very much dependent upon cheap credit, and therefore there's a possibility that it could cause a crash in the stock market.
Oh dear. Well, Mike, do you think some of the British quadrilla, or whatever they're called, gorilla, or I'm not sure what you call these people that do the fracking. Do you think they're looking across the Atlantic and a Godzilla, isn't it? And looking across the Atlantic and thinking, oh gosh, fracking's sort of starting to conk out over there. Maybe it's not such a good idea after all.
Yeah, I'm sure it will have dampened the enthusiasm of the industry to forge ahead as fast as they possibly can with fracking in Europe. Unfortunately, it hasn't dampened the enthusiasm of George Osborne and David Cameron, who remain thoroughly wedded to the idea that we should be putting everything in, well, either into the nuclear basket or the shale basket.
So what do you mean by that? Sorry.
Well, this last month, the government's announced the outcome of the auction that they held for energy projects. And it's an exaggeration to say they want to put everything into those two baskets, because they have awarded some contracts to big offshore wind farms, some onshore wind, some solar, but nowhere near the potential that those technologies could actually deliver for us. And they're ready to go now. We could be building big scale solar and wind installations that would get us, you know, reliable sources of energy at reasonable cost, get us off the hook of fossil fuels. We could be really rolling that out on a very big scale now, but the government instead seems to want to hold back from doing that and to put a lot of its hope in both the shale so-called revolution and the nuclear industry.
Well, talking about the nuclear stuff with Hinkley, I've been sort of hunting around to see if there are any news articles. There's only one. It's no big announcement. It's just over £2,500 has been granted to residents who live near Hinkley for earplugs. That's the only news over the last couple of weeks. So, I mean, it's not the multi-billions of pounds that they need to build a power station. It's only 2,500 quid, Mike.
Yeah, the multi-billion pounds are proving to be a little bit more problematic for them. Some commentators are now saying, you know, we're in the end game for Hinkley. The companies, Areva and EDF, that want to build the new nuclear industry, in Britain together with some Chinese companies, but those two are on the verge of bankruptcy and only be kept going by state support from the government in France, and desperately looking for the UK government to stump up, turn up with a blank checkbook and underwrite Hinkley. But the conditions that need to be satisfied for them to go ahead and build Hinkley are so ridiculously onerous for the British taxpayer, the British energy bill payer, that even some people in government and are starting to say that it's an unaffordable deal, and the Chinese backers are making some very stringent demands about the UK government underwriting the cost of any failure of the project.
Well, that means us, doesn't it?
That means us, yes. I say the UK government underwriting, yes, it means us as taxpayers basically underwriting the risk capital that these companies want to sink into building Hinkley. So the whole deal is looking less and less like it's going to have a viable outcome, and that really puts an end to the government's dream of a nuclear revival, nightmare of a nuclear revival in Britain for the foreseeable future.
Well, there's also a company called Areva, I noticed, an article from just a couple of weeks, well, actually, no, it's a week ago or so. EDF's given its strongest hint yet that ailing reactor maker Areva may pull out of funding the Hinkley Point new nuclear plant, telling reporters that their proposed financial stake was not existential for the project. So they've got the people that actually build the reactors, because I suppose that the reactor program across the world is being reined back, and particularly in Europe, and what with the Germans saying we're not having any, for example, that the people that build the reactors, they desperately need this work, otherwise they're going to go bankrupt.
They absolutely do. There are only two nuclear projects under construction in Europe, one in Finland and one in France. Areva's got a stake in both of those. Both those projects are absolutely mired in difficulties. They are running years behind schedule and two and three times over budget. So,
well, they're a bit of a naughty company, Areva. One of the things that you'll find if you look them up online is you find that they're one of the biggest records for cost overruns of any of these high tech firms, and yet they're kind of crucial, really, to this project.
Well, if nuclear is their main business, then I'm not at all surprised. It's been a feature throughout the history of the nuclear industry that they've always been subject to these massive cost overruns and delivering things behind, well behind schedule. Probably the only exception to that was EDF itself, which delivered a major program of nuclear in France, which has been the one program that I'm aware of nuclear development that actually sort of delivered more or less what it was supposed to. But it certainly every sort of time that a major nuclear program sputters into life here in the UK, it never delivers what it's supposed to. We always get, or the industry always delivers, less capacity, higher cost years later than it was supposed to have done, and I don't think Hinkley is going to prove any different from that abysmal track record. The only thing we can hope is that the deal falls off, falls apart, hopefully before they even start constructing it, but definitely before they put any nuclear fuel in it.
Okay, so the people will have earplugs, but then that's about it. They won't actually be using them for anything. Anyway, we'll see what happens with that. Finally, Stonehenge, the World Heritage Site. There's been big changes down there, aren't there? I'm not sure how far it's all got, but I know you're involved in this petition to save Stonehenge. Well, why is Stonehenge under threat? I thought it was a tunnel that was being built, something like that.
Yeah, that's right. This is a project that is one of these what we call zombie road schemes. They come back from the dead every now and then, a bit like nuclear power, really. The government has found a new enthusiasm for spending, despite these times of austerity. They want to spend up to £15 billion on major road schemes throughout the UK, of which they say £2 to £3 billion is allocated for schemes in the southwest. And the centrepiece of their programme is to make a dual carriageway, which goes all the way from sort of Hampshire right down to Devon.
Okay, so it's the A303, dueling the A303. They've been talking about that for decades, haven't they?
They have been talking about it for decades, and one of the problems they have is that right up at the top end of it, it crosses a World Heritage Site at Stonehenge. And that World Heritage Site is 4.5 kilometres wide, because the whole Stonehenge landscape is an incredible archaeological survival. It's a complex of what were regarded as sacred sites over millennia, before even the stones themselves were built.
But that road has got a weird rush hour, hasn't it? It's got this kind of Friday night rush hour where everyone from London who's got second homes in the West Country uses it, and it's also got another one on a Sunday night as everyone comes back to London from the West Country. It does seem a little bit silly to spend however many millions it is on dueling the whole section just for these few hours. Two times a week.
Yeah, if you look at what really the problem of traffic congestion in the southwest is, you mentioned it yourself earlier on, Tony, that Bristol is the biggest traffic congestion spot that needs to be sorted out in the southwest. But perhaps because various politicians have their second homes in the southwest, and they've made promises to business leaders in Devon and Cornwall, where there are a lot of marginal seats. It seems to be one of the things the left at the coalition actually agree on. So both David Cameron and Nick Clegg turned up at Stonehenge just before Christmas to promise this tunnel would be built. The problem is that the tunnel is only it's less than 3 kilometres long. The World Heritage Site is 4.5 kilometres across. So that means what they're committing to do essentially is to gouge 1.5 kilometres, nearly a mile, of dual carriageway into the surface of the World Heritage Site, which is kind of not what we promised to do when we signed up to the World Heritage Convention. And this is what's been called the most archaeologically sensitive land surface in Europe. So that's why we're members of the Stonehenge Alliance and are campaigning to save the Stonehenge World Heritage Site, because this would be an immensely damaging scheme.
Mike, how do people follow what you're up to at Southwest Friends of the Earth and get in touch?
The best way is to find us online. Our website is foe.co.uk. You can find Southwest from there. You can also find Bristol Friends of the Earth. You can find Southwest Friends of the Earth on Facebook. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm Mike _ Birkin, but that's BIRKIN. I'm not that hard to find, I don't think, on Twitter. One of the things we haven't had a chance to talk about today is Energy Champions. Really like to encourage people to find out more about that. For that, you want to find Bristol Energy Network. Perhaps another time we'll tell you about that.
Okay. What about for those that aren't on the internet? Because everything, you know, so far is internet, isn't it?
Yeah.
Do you have meetings in the city?
We actually do exist as a physical group, not just a virtual one. So we meet on, it's usually the second Tuesday of the month at Roll for the Soul Community Bike Cafe in the city centre. On, I always think of it as being on Nelson Street, but I think the postal address actually isn't that. Anyway, it's just next to St John's Church, the church with the hole in it, where the arch goes, the road goes through.
Oh, it used to be part of
the
city wall,
Yep, that's right. And Roll for the Soul Community Cafe is there, and that's where Bristol Friends of the Earth meets, usually on the second Tuesday in the month.
Okay, Mike Birkin, thanks very much for joining us again.
You're welcome.
Representing the entire city, this is BCFM. BCFM 93.2.
Now, Martin, on to a look around the world and what's been going on this week, particularly, hotspots of various sorts. And before we hear from Henry Kissinger talking about the East-West divide and the new Cold War, what are your thoughts about where the hotspots are this week?
Well, obviously, I think the Ukraine is potentially the most dangerous hotspot on the planet because of the potential for a confrontation between Russia and NATO. But of course, there's lots of other things going on. Syria is still a crying shame and a mess. And that is linked to what's going on in Ukraine, because the Russians are on the and the West are on opposite sides of that.
Well, I'm going to give you something to think about now, because the Defence Secretary, Philip Hammond, has been talking a lot about the threat from Russia this week. So let's have a listen to what he had to say.
We are now faced with a Russian leader bent not on joining the international rules-based system, which keeps the peace between nations, but on subverting it. President Putin's actions, illegally annexing Crimea and using Russian troops to destabilize eastern Ukraine, fundamentally undermine the security of the sovereign nations of Eastern Europe. The rapid pace with which Russia is seeking to modernize her military forces and weapons, combined with the increasingly aggressive stance of the Russian military, including Russian aircraft around the sovereign airspace of NATO member states, are all significant causes for concern. So we are in familiar territory for anyone over the age of about 50, with Russia's aggressive behavior a stark reminder that it has the potential to pose the single greatest threat to our security, and hence continuing to gather intelligence on Russia's capabilities and intentions will remain a vital part of our intelligence effort for the foreseeable future. It is no coincidence that all of our agencies are recruiting Russian speakers again.
Well, I find this extremely tendentious. They want the Russians to be the enemy, and they're going out of their way to make them our enemy. But unlike the height of the Cold War, Russia is a democratic country, and you could argue in many respects that Putin is a more democratically elected leader, and he's certainly got more popular support in his country than many Western politicians. I mean, George Bush was re-elected twice, in both occasions, in my view, on a thieved ballot. Where the ballot boxes were, or the equivalent of ballot boxes were hacked and messed around with. The Russian democracy is in fact in better shape than democracy, for example, in Greece, where people can vote for who they want, and then they're told what to do by the European Central Bank, the IMF, and the European Commission. I think this talking up Russia as an enemy, we ought to be regarding Russia as a potential partner in resolving the various crises that we face, not least the economic crisis. How intelligent is it to try and deliberately crash the Russian economy when the German economy is largely dependent on the Russian economy? So we're actually, the Americans are pushing for the Russian economy to crash the German economy so that they can be top dog in the world. This is very tendentious, very dangerous. The Russians are behaving very calmly considering the provocation they've been under, because don't forget that the coup in Kiev this time last year was carried out by elements within the new regime who are extremely violent, probably carried out the shootings of the protesters, the shooting of the MH17 airline. All the evidence suggests that was carried out by aircraft from Kiev. In other words, the Russians are being set up here. If we were dealing with Khrushchev, they probably wouldn't try and push them around in the way they are. And this demonization of Putin is also completely silly. If Putin was to die tomorrow, somebody else would take over, but the policy would remain the same. My favourite person to take over would be Putin's advisor, Sergei Glazyev, who is Putin's brain. Now, Putin's a pretty clever fellow. Glazyev is a really clever fellow. And if the West wants to play poker with him, then that's what they'll get if they got rid of Putin, or possibly Zyuganov, head of the Communist Party, which is the biggest opposition party in Russia, although you wouldn't believe it from the way the Western media reports things over there.
Now, when Vladimir Putin made his State of the Nation address, which I suppose is, I don't know whether in the Soviet times they did this kind of thing, but it was headlined, "Remember the lessons we taught Hitler." That was December last year. He was saying things like that the West would have gladly applied the Yugoslav scenario to dismemberment and disintegration for Russia back in 1990. They failed. We did not allow them to do that. He also said for centuries Crimea was part of Russia. The peninsula is ethnically Russian, not just Russian-speaking. However, in 1954 it was transferred to Ukraine by Nikita Khrushchev, who believed national boundaries were irrelevant and that they all come within the banner of the Soviet Union. He also talked about the US and EU trying to play up the effect that sanctions imposed on Russia are having within the country, when in fact the low price of oil is the real reason for that. We were just talking about that, for the ruble slide. Putin says Russia is looking for new partners in the East for trade and believes the West's aim to hurt Russia will be detrimental to them in the long run.
Well, the people who are going to lose out from a confrontation with Russia are the Europeans. But, of course, it's the US that's pushing for a confrontation with Russia because they'd hardly do any business with Russia. So it's countries in Eastern Europe in particular that are going to suffer from this. And, of course, you've seen the questions are now beginning to be asked about whether this is a sensible policy. Angela Merkel has said she rules out categorically arming the Kiev regime. Nevertheless, the Americans and the British keep banging the war drum and saying that they are going to arm the Kiev regime. Now, what could happen here, ultimately, is that Germany will split with the US over this. That's probably what should happen. NATO is an organisation which has long passed its useful functions, and it should basically be abolished. And we should set up a completely different security structure where we're working cooperatively with the Russians to deal with mutual problems. And we're so far away from that now, it seems like a joke to mention it.
Another, in the Putin State of the Nation address last December was, he said, our US friends, whether directly or from behind the scenes, always affect our relations with our neighbours. Sometimes it's unclear whether to talk to the authorities of the country or to their US patrons. He also said, if for many European countries sovereignty and national pride are forgotten concepts and a luxury, for Russia, true sovereignty is an absolutely necessary condition for our existence.
Well, I mean, he's putting his finger right on it there, isn't he? And this is exactly what the problem is. I think the Europeans will be extremely stupid to be dragged into a war with Russia to suit the neoconservatives in the United States of America. And it may be that they've just overplayed their hand to such an extent that we could end up in 2 years' time with the breakup of NATO, along with the breakup of the European Union, possibly.
Well, you mentioned the European Union, and we had last weekend the EU Commission chief making a case for a European army. This is in the EU Observer. European Commission President Jean-Claude Juncker has said the EU should establish its own army to show Russia it is serious about defending European values. In an interview with Die Welt am Sonntag, Juncker said Europe has lost a huge amount of respect in foreign policy too. We don't seem to be taken entirely seriously. An army would allow the EU to react in a credible manner to threats of peace in a member state or in a neighbouring country.
Well, this is interesting because I think what's going on here is essentially a signal to the Americans. The Americans and the British are opposed to having a European army. They think NATO is what it's all about. So Juncker suggesting a European army is actually undermining NATO. But of course, we don't really need a European army to fight the Russians. We need to actually cooperate with the Russians. We shouldn't be fighting with them at all. So in other words, we're getting ourselves into a complete mess because we're pursuing entirely the wrong policy. And I come back to what happened in Kiev this time last year. The transfer of power was not a legitimate transfer of power, and it looks very clear to me that the snipers, which actually killed the protesters and the police officers, which led to the coup, were snipers associated with the far right in the Ukraine and probably associated with NATO intelligence services. Now, in other words, NATO goes around bombing things, blowing things up, and then blaming others for what they have done, and then trying to start wars on the back of it. And we've actually got evidence going back decades now of NATO's terrorist infrastructure in places like Turkey, Italy, Belgium, etc. Ultimately, terrorists have to be confronted. And that means, effectively, we're going to have to smash the Western intelligence services because they are the primary promoters of terrorism on the planet, including Islamist terrorism. They are the main sponsors of it.
OK, before we go off the subject of Russia, this came up in Parliament this week. And on Today in Parliament, I was listening to on Radio 4, and up popped this chap called Rory Stewart, who's the chairman now of the Defence Committee, also a regular invitee to the Bilderberg conferences. Mm-hmm. He is one of the people who's very much pushing an increase in defence spending, even though we're living in an age of austerity, and we're going to hear from him now.
The Conservative chair of the Defence Committee, Rory Stewart, said both reviews had relied on two assumptions.
Firstly, that the Cold War has ended. So if you read the National Security Strategy, it says again and again throughout that strategy, the Cold War has ended, we need to be much bolder about getting rid of Cold War capacities. And secondly, that essentially what we will be doing in the future were the kinds of things that were happening in 2010, primarily Afghanistan. So absolutely central to the SDSR was the idea that what we need is something called enduring stabilisation operations. That basically meant that we were planning to go in for a very long time with very large number of troops into a single country, or at most in the US planning, two countries at a time.
And now he's saying, actually, we may have a confrontation with Russia on the cards.
Well, the reason why they're pushing a confrontation with Russia, and Rory Stewart is very much an insider, he's been at the Bilderberg conferences and all the rest of it, is because they can't actually solve the economic problems of the West. And therefore, what will happen if we do get into an armed confrontation with the Russians, and there is then a stock market crash, the stock market crash will be blamed on Putin. But of course, it isn't Putin's fault if the US and British stock markets crash.
But isn't it more that they actually don't want to solve the economic problems?
No, well,
that actually,
can't.
What's happening is
they can't.
What's happening is a lot of wealth is being funneled away from savers and from the poor into the hands of the rich.
Well, indeed, and ultimately that's
unsustainable. Why should they want to stop that?
Well, no, they don't want to stop it. But what's happening is one of the biggest wealth transfers in history through the manipulation of the financial markets. The Russians are very well aware of this. The Russians have bent over backwards. When they talk about a rules-based system, the Russians have bent over backwards to try and cooperate. You see, the language Putin is using, our American friends. That's what he calls them. They don't call him their friend. They call him the worst thing since Hitler. But he still refers to them as our friends and partners. The Russians' language shows that they are the statesmen and that the Western leaders are basically pygmies. The danger of a confrontation over the Ukraine is enormous. But of course, it won't. The cookie won't necessarily crumble the way the warmongers want it to. Looks what's happened in East Ukraine. The Dad's Army, because it really is locals who are providing most of the muscle, have thrashed the Kiev junta's forces. Because the Kiev junta's forces are made up of conscripts who don't want to fight, and far-right battalions funded by big oligarchs who are basically thugs, and we are actually implicated in all their thuggery. And ultimately, of course, I'm not a pacifist. I'm less of a pacifist than Rory Stewart. And ultimately, for example, if the British forces, British soldiers, go into East Ukraine where they've voted for independence from Kiev, they are going to be killed. And they will deserve to be killed, because ultimately I'm not a pacifist any more than anybody else is. If you come to my country to try and suppress my right to independence, I'm going to kill you. And that's what's going to happen to the West if they carry on down this road.
Now, we mentioned last week Sir John Sawers, who's the former Director General of MI6, the British Secret Intelligence Services, Foreign Intelligence Service, the old sort of James Bond service with the license to kill abroad. We've heard from the Defence Secretary, Philip Hammond. We've also heard from the Chairman of the Defence Select Committee, Rory Stewart. Now, let's hear from a former spook, the head of MI6, on the Russian threat.
Russia has always been an issue of concern for us. We had hoped in the 1990s that Russia and Europe were on a path of convergence with one another. We now know, because of the behaviour of Russia over the last 6 or 8 years, that is no longer the case. They are not converging with one another. Europe and Russia are not converging with one another. So we're going to have to find a new way to coexist with Russia. This crisis at the moment, it's focused on Ukraine, but Ukraine is a symptom. It's not the real problem. The real problem is how we live with a Russia which feels very exposed. Putin's actions are ones of a leader who believes his own security is at stake. And here we've got, you know, nuclear bombers approaching the Cornish coast. We've got threatening
noises. It is a threat,
noises.
Then. It is Russia is a danger to us in the West?
It certainly has become a danger.
How much of a danger?
Well, I think the level of threat posed by Russia has increased, and we have to be prepared to take the defensive measures necessary to defend ourselves, defend our allies, which now extend as far as the Baltic states and Central Europe. And that's going to be a big issue, I think, in the Strategic Defence and Security Review after the election, because we clearly have, since the Cold War, run down our defence spending quite considerably as a proportion of GDP. The measure is not so much the percentage that we spend of national wealth on defence, but we've got to have the capability to deal with things like the hybrid warfare that we've seen Russia deploy first in Crimea and then in the Donbass region. We've got to have the ability to deal with cyber warfare. There's a political importance attached to that 2%. But what's really important is that we are able to fulfil all our defence commitments, and I think that the that's going to require a reversal in the trend in defence spending. We're going to have to spend more on our defence and security because the threats are greater, because we're living in a more dangerous world.
That was Sir John Sawers there, who was the former Director General of MI6, the Secret Intelligence Service, the Foreign Intelligence Service. Martin, he's talking there about this hybrid warfare. What does that mean?
Well, what he means is that, as I mentioned a moment ago, is that the volunteer battalions of the Novorossian Army have thrashed the Ukrainian Army, and they didn't expect that. That's because, basically, they're fighting for their country as they see it. They had a referendum in in Donbass and Luhansk. They voted to be independent of Kiev, just like Slovenia voted to be independent of Yugoslavia, just like Kosovo voted to be independent of Serbia. And we actually went to war to give Kosovo independence from Serbia. The RAF and the USAF bombed Serbia and killed thousands of civilians to make them disgorge Kosovo, even though Kosovo was an integral part of the Serbian Republic under Tito. Now, the same thing has happened in Crimea and East Ukraine, because we overthrew the government in the West Ukraine, in Kiev, and now suddenly the West is saying, oh, this is inadmissible, etc., etc. They have deliberately provoked the Russians because the military-industrial complex in the West wants our money, and they also want an excuse for the banking crash, which is just around the corner. It's very dangerous times. It's a good job the Russian leadership is as competent as they are, otherwise we'd already be over the waterfall into World War III.
Well, let's hear from one of the spokespeople of the criminal elite. I mean, he's a war criminal, a well-recorded war criminal. He's Henry Kissinger, and he had some advice this week for NATO.
NATO needs to develop a strategy for the future, and it should hold exercises that are relevant to the strategy and to what it is prepared to do. They should be doing it if they are convinced about their strategic purposes and if that exercise fits into it. The strategic purposes must be to defend and protect the territorial integrity of the members of NATO, and they have to develop strategies and capacities to meet this objective. They don't necessarily have to be at the precise point of attack, but they have to be relevant to it. They have found it difficult to accept the proposition that Cold War conditions may be returning, and secondly, because the vast majority of NATO governments have subordinated defense expenditures to domestic programs, and therefore they haven't had the capacity to develop a meaningful strategy to deal with a major attack. I think NATO has to develop military capacities that are relevant to dangers that they foresee. And if they are determined, as they should be, to resist further Russian military moves, it means that the defense limitations have to be lifted. Is it inevitable that we are in a Cold War strategy with Russia? I have had a view that at the beginning of the Ukrainian crisis, a more flexible diplomacy could have avoided many of the disasters that have befallen us, and probably protected a much larger area of Ukraine than has been the case. But at the point where we are now, I think it is essential that both Russia and NATO take a serious look at their diplomatic options, because if they fail, then I think a return to Cold War conditions is very likely.
Well, he's talking there about Cold War being inevitable, or strategy being inevitable, Martin.
Well, interestingly enough, some of the things that Kissinger has been saying is that we've backed Putin into a corner here, and we've overplayed our hand. We didn't get that from his rather Delphic pronouncement there. It's a we're not. I would say it's not a Cold War. It's a hot war. It's already a hot war. I'm quite sure British mercenaries are fighting with the Kiev forces, with the advice of British military advisers, against people who are being advised by the Russians. People are dying. The Cold War was full of murder and mayhem. The South Africans, as they destroyed Angola, Mozambique and other frontline states, were being supported by the West to destroy those countries. So the Cold War was full of mayhem and murder. In Central America, up to hundreds of thousands of people were killed by the Western forces, and it's still going on.
In the background to all this, Putin is signing the law this week on the ratification of a $100 billion BRICS new development bank deal. This is basically saying bye-bye to the IMF.
Yeah, well, what's beginning to happen, because of the belligerent attitude since 9/11 of the Western elites, countries which were actually well disposed towards us. The Russian elite are wealthy capitalists. They would love to do business with the West, but the West basically has shafted them. So they're now turning away from doing business with us and looking for alternatives. And who can blame them? The people running the West are political pygmies. I've said it earlier. They are going to run us into a war on the back of this airy rhetoric, which is completely inappropriate. Look at the way the Russians are using language. They continually refer to that our American partners are British friends. What do? We go, yah, boo, sucks. It's pathetic.
Now, the Jewish former head of the U.S. Army War College, Aaron Sobrowski, disagrees with the Bishop of Guildford, who has put a rather strange thing onto the Reverend Stephen Sizer down at Virginia Water, saying he's not allowed to talk about the Middle East, over whether the Israeli government and military may have been involved as part of the terrorist 9/11 attacks. And we're going to hear now a recent interview with Alan Sobrowski, who's been banned from the British airwaves because Ofcom have banned the English-language Iranian channel Press TV that conducted the interview. So let's now hear from the former head of the U.S. Army War College, Alan Sobrowski.
I began to have suspicions about what had happened on 9/11 about 2 weeks after the attacks. There were several discontinuities that made no sense to me whatsoever. The behavior on the part of some of the named terrorists, these 19 Arabs on four planes, running around flying schools like loose cannon, not having the pilot skills to fly the aircraft, no recognition for what they had done afterwards in their own area, their own community. And it struck me that for many reasons, none of the arguments that were being given for what they did made any sense. But I then immediately forgot about it until about 2 years ago. And then I came across a video which I found to be extremely disturbing. That video was an interview with a Dutch demolitions expert named Danny Jawenko. And it concerned the collapse of the third World Trade Center tower to go down on September 11th. This was the 47-story World Trade Center 7, the third tallest building at the World Trade Center. Jawenko had never heard of it. Neither had I. And when you looked at the building, you saw that there was effectively no damage to any face of the building. It had not been hit by a plane. It had not been taken major trauma from debris. And it went straight down into its own footprint in about 7 seconds in what was visibly a controlled demolition. You know, and it was pretty clear that whatever those 19 named Arabs on four planes, two of them at the World Trade Center, had or had not done, they could not have had any possible effect on that third building going down. Shortly after that, I came across, partly out of my own curiosity, which this definitely aroused, and a very extensive video, both of which I've cited, by the way, in some of my recent articles, which were taken on 9/11 itself from what became Ground Zero, the base of World Trade Center 1 and 2, the Twin Towers, involving police, emergency services personnel, newspaper and television correspondents. And you can see and hear secondary explosions at the base of the World Trade Center buildings. Now, planes impacting at 800 to 1,000 feet above the ground are not going to cause secondary explosions at the ground floor. And this followed over into other reports also there on September 11th, about vans in the area, white vans. In one case, a van was picked up by police and people arrested at the access to a major bridge. The van was filled with explosives, and the two people in it were Israelis. In Bergen, New Jersey, same day, a van with several people in it had set up cameras. Before the first plane hit, they were filming the Twin Towers, and they were celebrating. High fives. It was a good thing for them. Residents called police. Police arrested them. All five were Israelis. What intrigued me, in addition to angering me, was that within days, all of these reports disappeared from the media. Most Americans don't know that a third building went down at the World Trade Center. Most have never heard about the secondary explosions reported by CNN, ABC, Fox, and others at the foundation of World Trade Center 1 and 2. None have ever heard about the vans. So I began looking at this very carefully, and one of the things that I began looking at was just what would it have taken for a special operations group of any particular nationality to have done 9/11, either by having taken control of the operation we have been told about, of the 19 named Arabs on four planes, or having run a parallel operation where you have four planes being hijacked, but there is another operation being done with those in concert. And I picked up three particular factors that would need to be taken into account. One was motivation, a second was expertise, and the third, the critical one, was access. Now, when it came to motivation, it's probably a very sad commentary on where we are in the world today, that there are an awful lot of countries and groups out there in the world that have either real or contrived reasons to hate America. It wasn't that way when I was a young man, but then many things weren't the same way now as they were when I was a young man. But almost all of the groups and countries that might want to do this only had a negative reason for doing it. They wanted to hurt us. The Israelis had a positive reason, and it's one that a number of their supporters had talked about from the 1990s on up, and what was called the Project for a New American Century, whose members included, by the way, later Vice President Richard Cheney, later Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld, and many of the so-called neoconservatives, most of them Jewish but not all, who came into the first Bush administration. Israel had a positive reason, and was get the United States involved in a war in the Middle East with a powerful, enraged, anti-Islamic strain within the American public, that they needed a catalytic event to produce this. They even talked about it in terms of another Pearl Harbor is needed to bring the American people into this fight. The second was expertise. Lots of expertise out there. Bringing buildings down and controlled demolitions is something that almost any intelligence agency of any country in the world can do or can contract. There are many private agencies that do this. But one thing is absolutely clear. Neither those 19 named Arabs on the plane nor Al-Qaeda as an organization had the expertise, the technical expertise to do that. And there is one very clear proof of that. If Al-Qaeda and its affiliates had had the ability to wire even one building for a controlled demolition at the World Trade Center, much less all three of them, the so-called green zone in the heart of Baghdad would have been a pile of rubble. And it wasn't. But the last is access. The World Trade Center security was an Israeli-owned company. Security at all three of the airports from which the four aircraft on 9/11 departed, ICTS, was an Israeli security company. That security company, by the way, also had security at the airports in Paris and Amsterdam later from which the so-called shoe and underwear bombers departed. The security company at the World Trade Center had 24/7 state-of-the-art electronic surveillance and foot patrols. Wiring a building for a controlled demolition, and I must confess here, this is not my specialty. I have heard what people who do this for a living have said about it, but it is not my specialty. But the description of it and the video of Danny Jawenko that I mentioned to you is a very good one on this. And he described it in which if you needed to do it in a few hours, you would need 30 to 40 people, fewer if you had more time, cutting open the walls, literally cutting open the walls, all the way around the building, implanting the explosives, running detonator cord and cable, wires to put them to a control system, coordinating all of this activity. This is not something that involves the casual bringing in of a briefcase and leaving it at the foot of a building's elevator and going out again. This is extensive work, and it would require the type of extensive, sustained access that could not go unremarked by the security forces in place on this. They also needed the ability to evade and apprehension and to have their escape concealed. And they had that done. All of the Israelis who were apprehended in those vans were later released in about 2 months at the direction of Michael Chertoff, then the second director of Homeland Security, a dual U.S.-Israeli national. There is no mention of them in the mainstream media, which is largely Zionist-owned. All of the major networks, all of the major national newspapers, all three of the weekly news magazines, all of the major political journals, most of the major publishing houses. It simply didn't happen. The only thing that happened on 9/11 that was discussed in the media, that would have been accepted by the government, that was described in the 9/11 Commission, are 19 named Arabs on four planes bringing down two buildings. And the rest of it, in Orwellian terms, has become a non-event and a non-story. Back in the early 80s, when I was in Washington at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, one of our visitors for a luncheon talk was a young gentleman then named Francois Heisberg. Heisberg was the special assistant to French President François Mitterrand. And I don't know how this subject came up, but he said, you know, Americans never see conspiracies anywhere. We French, he said, we see conspiracies everywhere. And both of us are wrong. This is not a conspiracy in the sense that it is usually used, the word is usually used, which is to denigrate an opposing argument. When someone in the United States says that that's a conspiracy or that's a conspiracy theory, by definition they mean it is irrational, illegitimate, and without proof. All I would suggest to people is that you look at the films of WTC-7, that third tower going down on September 11th. You look and listen to the reports on September 11th with the secondary explosions. These are not fantasies. They happened.
That was Alan Zabrowski there, Lieutenant Colonel in the US Marines and former head of the US Army War College. And I'll put a link up on our show page, which is thisweek.org.uk, so you can watch the full interview. And it's on Press TV, which is now banned by Ofcom here in Britain. And none of our media really seem to be putting Alan Zabrowski on Newsnight or anything like that, do they?
No, and the other fact is that he is actually Jewish. He's a Jewish American officer accusing the Israelis of carrying out 9/11. Is he an anti-Semite? No, he's a patriot.
We have, I think we'll have to do Stephen Sizer next week because we're running out of time now. But ultimately, do stay tuned. Next week, we'll be back at 5 o'clock on Friday. It's Tony Gosling here. You can follow me on Twitter at Tony Gosling in between times. But in the meantime, don't let those banksters get you down.
The Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 7, footage has emerged of three British schoolgirls apparently obtaining false passports on their way to Syria. The teenagers from East London left their homes last month. The video apparently sees them meeting with a foreign spy who's now been arrested by Turkish police. Middle East reporter Tom Rayner says using Syrian documents has become the preferred method of smuggling people over the border.
It's very, very dangerous now. The Turkish military have stepped up their patrols along it. They're digging big trenches, there's minefields, and there's also fighting. So people are opting, it seems, for these false documents so that they can use those Turkish border crossings.
A service has been held to mark the end of the Afghanistan conflict. The Queen and former Prime Minister Tony Blair were amongst those present at the service at St Paul's Cathedral. Neil Fox has been arrested in connection with an alleged sexual offence against a woman in the early 1990s. It's the third time the radio DJ's been held over sexual assault allegations. The inquest into the Hillsborough disaster has heard a police chief called for dogs instead of ambulances. It was the latest in a number of admissions from former Chief Superintendent David Duckenfield.